listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, BC. This radio is diverse, independent, and always yours. Check us out at cjsf.ca or search CJSF 90.1 FM on SoundCloud.
Welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, February 17th, 2023. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, we feature a segment from our most recent Off the Hill political panel. This month, our theme was Off the Hill, Tackling Systemic Inequalities. This month is Black History Month. In our political panel this month, we examined the critical issues facing us in Canada this month, including the privatization of healthcare and federal-provincial agreements, the ongoing space right-wing sentiment has in mainstream culture, and some of the initiatives happening across the country to address systemic racism and inequality. Our February panel included MP Matthew Green, Richard Sharp, Stephen Brown, and Carl Nirenberg, hosted by Robin Brown. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
So to kick off tonight's panel, we'd like to focus on the mainstream media and particularly the political reactions to the announcement of Canada's first Islamophobia Commissioner, Amira El-Gawabi. We saw nothing short of vitriolic reaction from Quebec politicians and from the media in general to comments by El-Gawabi and her co-author Bernie Farber in her written observations about Islamophobia in Canada and Quebec's Bill 21, which bans provincial public servants from wearing religious symbols. So so this is a question to each of you, and is this: how do you assess the reactions to El-Gawabi, and what are the implications, if any, for members of Black communities who are calling for a Black Equity Commissioner similar to El-Gawabi, but who would address systemic anti-Black racism? And we'll go Stephen, Matthew, Richard, Carl. So Stephen, to you first.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for having me here. Salut tout le monde. Hello, everybody. Coming to you from Montreal. It's pretty clear that the reaction to her appointment is proof of the necessity of this position. For anybody that's been paying close attention, or even not that close attention, to the debate around Bill 21 and how it came to be, it's pretty clear that this Bill 21 is a religiously bigoted law. And the comments that were really targeted by a firestorm in the media were basically coming right after the passing of Bill 21. And really, for anybody who was actually listening to what was going on, to what the Prime Minister of Le Premier Ministre of Quebec, François Legault, was saying, it's very clear that this was done in reaction to a rising malaise in the general population of visible minorities, notably Muslim women. I mean, after they passed the law, he literally said in an interview with Radio-Canada, sometimes you got to give a little bit to the majority because there are some racist people out there who don't want to see people wearing religious garb even in the streets. So I think the entire reaction to her appointment is really, really troubling. And I think it points to the fact that this position is really needed. It's absolutely crucial. And when we think about as the Black community, we're a community that's been dealing with discrimination for many years. To me, it highlights the fact that there are some people that are just never going to be comfortable with the fact that you're pointing out discrimination. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. The motion from the Bloc against the use of the notwithstanding clause, all the discussion was all about how people feel uncomfortable with being called out for discriminating against minorities. And the fact of the matter is that if you want to make progress sometimes you're going to have to make some people uncomfortable. I think it's much more important for us to focus on how are we bringing systemic issues to systemic problems. And if those systemic problems are discrimination, well, unfortunately, people who are doing the discriminating are going to be called out and they may not like it. But I don't think we can, I don't think we should pay too much attention to their hurt feelings. I think we should pay more attention to the necessity and the, and ensuring that everybody in this country is treated as an equal. That's what really matters, right?
No, thank you, Stephen. Now, Matthew, over to you. How do you assess the reactions to El Gawabi? And again, what are the implications?
I'm still trying to digest that Stephen just said that Legault went on and actually admitted that, said the quiet parts out loud. Did I understand that correctly, Stephen?
Yeah, he said, he literally said, I'll quote it in French, pour éviter les extrêmes, des fois, il faut en donner un peu à la majorité, parce que les gens qui sont un peu racistes. Like, that is literally, and I quote what he said.
Wow. Right?
And then when he justified the use of the notwithstanding clause, he basically said something. So it was very, very clear to anybody who was paying attention to the debate in French that this was about curtailing people's rights. Yeah.
You know, and so to that point, I would say that in terms of what is my reaction or how do I assess the reaction, it's predictable. And we've watched this now for quite some time in the way in which these issues are communicated. It is... these arguments about secularism kind of veiling the underlying issues, not just in Quebec, but I would say like across the country, notions of free speech, right? Notions of freedom of expression. These are all kind of part of a reactionary backlash to multiculturalism. And it's in the midst of a culture war that is, certainly to the point underscores how necessary it is to explore these topics. The other thing that I want to just really highlight is the ways in which our Black communities exist in so many different ways. The fact that we have Stephen here today, hopefully should be a reminder that when we're talking about Islamophobia, we're also talking about anti-Blackness, because we have a ton of Black Muslims across the country. When you think about the attacks that were happening in Alberta, these were on Somali sisters. You know, when we think about the attacks that that have happened in almost all instances of Islamophobia, they have also had Black victims. And I think that one of the ways that we need to be better responding as a community, if I could go further, is to say that we need to recognize that and understand that their struggle is our struggle, even if we don't happen to be Muslim, that our sisters and brothers and family are within the Muslim community and are a part of those attacks. And the rage machine, like what is rewarded right now in media, is rage. And the rage farming that happens has created an ecosystem where small issues, culture war issues, are used to basically drive traffic and drive reaction and to feed a reactionary economy in terms of what we're seeing right now in the media. So again, it's a predictable response. And I would also agree with Stephen that it is a testament that this is exactly what we need in this moment. And I think one of the best examples of that, when they tried to make it about her, and you'll recall Blanchette from the Bloc dragged her into a meeting to basically have her hat in hand apologize for the comments and then immediately go out and do a press conference calling for her resignation. Yeah. It was never about Sister El Gawabi. It was always about the position and the threat to this reactionary culture war that is sometimes driven by ethno-nationalism and other times just driven by straight anti-Muslim hate. And I use that word specifically because, you know, Islamophobia would suggest that people are afraid of Muslims. I'm not sure that's the case. I'm not sure they're afraid of Muslims. I think that there is an underlying hatred that is also fueled by some, you know, a deeply held religious kind of Christo dominionism that some people would like to see in this country. So yeah, buckle up, because I can just predict that things are likely to get worse before they get better.
Thanks, Richard. Over to you, Matt. How do you assess the reaction? And again, what are the implications for, if any, for members of Black communities who are calling for a Black Equity Commissioner similar to the El Gawabi position?
Yeah, well, I agree with my my two brothers here on the panel, what was really disappointing, but as Matthew said, predictable, is that all of this kerfuffle about the comments made back in the day, where those comments were based on data, were based on reports that were actually released. They were just, you know, restating facts that came out of those reports about the penchant for people who are who hold, you know, anti-Muslim sentiments to support basically anti-Muslim, anti-racialized people who are religious legislation. That they support those things, partly because it's not about the data. It's not about the reality, the truth of data. It's about how people feel. And I did want to go back a little bit to what Matthew was saying, that, you know, they might not fear Muslims, but they do fear the change that's coming in this country. They fear the growing numbers of Black and brown people and people with religious who wear religious garments and clothes and express themselves in a non-pure Len way. And I think that sentiment is across the country. We have declining birth rates in Western nations. Canada is no different. And the saving grace is immigration. That immigration is spawning not only new people coming in, but new people coming in and mixing with the dominant group. So the change is coming quick in terms of the complexion of this country. So it's unfortunate, but I think it's true that we have to figure out a way, if we're talking about solutions, how to manage that fear of the change that's coming. It's not the great replacement, but that a lot of these folks are concerned about, but it definitely is a great changeover in terms of representation in this country. And so for those in Quebec, you know, I could say a lot about our brothers and sisters and colleagues and friends who work in that province. You know, being the sort of perpetual victim of white Angloism is lost when, in order to sort of defend your sense of self, you have to go after, discriminate against, to belittle, marginalize, racialized people, people of different religious backgrounds. So I think that, you know, that's based on the fear of what's coming, and so that is something that sells papers. That is something, that vitriol that comes out of that discomfort with the change, that sells papers. That so the media does prey on that. I'll say very quickly, with respects to the Black Equity Commissioner, which a number of us are calling for. I think it speaks to the institutional change that we need to make, or institutional systems and structures that we need to put in place to support people of African descent in this country. We have nothing right now. Employment equity, human rights, even the charter doesn't adequately protect the rights of Black people in this country. That's why we see such disparities in terms of our outcomes in this country. But it does make one pause. Because in just the same way that Amira is going to point out things that are facts and that are statistically grounded in research, so would an equity commissioner, and that will run afoul of the people that are afraid of all this chocolate in the space. So I do agree that it does pose challenges, but it's not insurmountable. It's not impossible. I think we can do a lot with such a structure, such an institution, and I think it's going to happen. If not called for by Canadians, then it'll probably be something that's pressed internationally with those of us who are working in the UN and other spaces.
Thank you. And Carl, you wrote about this week, I think this week, on this issue. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, so much has been said about it already that this, I don't want to be redundant. I would say where we're going to go from here, so I'll move it forward, is to pick up on Richard's very important point that we have a real reckoning in Canada. I guess we, the majority, but still white majority in Canada, have a reckoning to say, if we did not have immigration, we would disappear as a country. We would start having a declining population, and a declining population is a death sentence. People like me, who are senior citizens, wouldn't have anybody to pay taxes and work and produce to give us the services and healthcare that we think we're due. We can't live without immigration. We cannot survive without immigration. We're not reproducing ourselves here in Canada without immigration. And we have to, and immigrants, by and large, are not coming mostly from the old source of immigrants from Europe, but from everywhere else in the world. And more, not only from Asia, as they had for a fair time, a bit of time, and the Caribbean, but also from Africa and sub-Saharan Africa. And many of those immigrants are Muslim or other, or Hindu or other, or Sikh or various other non-Christian religions. And we're going to have to figure out how to make sense of it. I, of course, love it and welcome it. I'll tell you just a personal anecdote, how Canada's changed, and I'm the oldest person on this panel. My wife and I lived and worked as CUSO volunteers in the 1970s in northern Nigeria, which is an Islamic part of Nigeria. And I have to tell you, it was a great source of excitement for us. Every once in a while, we'd meet a Nigerian in Canada. There were very few. A Nigerian was an unusual person to run across in Canada. It was a big deal, and we would have a conversation. And now, I mean, you get into a taxi in Toronto, just as likely to be Nigerian as anybody else, or you meet people in the street. And there's, I mean, now we have a huge Nigerian diaspora, as we have for many, many other communities. I mean, we didn't know Somali Canadians in the 1970s. This has all completely changed, but we need these people. We absolutely need this energy and this creativity and these people to keep the country moving, and we have to start facing that. And it's, yes, Quebec then becomes a more complicating factor, because Quebecers, when I think of this controversy, I think of that TV commercial for eating eggs for supper, where some guy says, "Oh, you're weird for eating eggs," and then the gal says, "Oh, you're weird for thinking I'm weird." So you have people pointing to Quebec and saying, "Well, Law 21 is racist. It's as people like me say, Law 21 is not about preserving a secular character of Quebec. It does nothing about preserving a secular character of Quebec. The same time as they're passing that law, the Quebec government is giving the most generous subsidies in the world to religious-based schools, almost all of them Catholic schools. They don't care. I mean, they don't. It's just picking on people whose religious practice is visible in some way. So if you have some real crazy fanatic religious person, but he just wears a three-piece suit and goes to work, we don't care about him, as long as he doesn't put a sign on his head saying, "This is my religion." But so you point to Quebec, and then they say, "Well, you're racist for calling us that." You know, and it is sometimes true, and in my article I pointed out, sometimes there are people who want to pick on Quebec. I had a conversation with somebody I knew who's Jewish and said, "You know, it's only in Quebec where you saw signs saying, you know, no Jews or dogs allowed in this hotel." I said, "Well, I'll tell you a secret. My in-laws, who are Jewish, on their honeymoon in Florida, big sign, no Jews, N-word people, or dogs allowed," right there. They were, their car broke down and they just lied. And they just said, "We're nice Christian people. Can we just stay here for the night?" So, you know, Quebec is no more racist than the rest of North America. You know, as they had fascists in Quebec in the 1930s, you had Nazi rallies in Madison Square Gardens where people were saluting Hitler. I mean, it's not, there's no difference, yeah. And it's not fair to pick on Quebec, but Law 21 is a particularly odious and bigoted and racist piece of legislation.
Jump in really quickly just to say something that actually points to everything that Matthew, Richard, and Carl were saying. Being a Quebecer myself, what's really clear to me is what this really comes down to is the use of the notwithstanding clause. Because in Quebec, it comes back exactly to what does the future of the country look like? And that is why all minorities should be really concerned about this. Because the prevailing attitude in Quebec right now is how we have this great tool. How can we take away the rights of minorities until they have no option but to live like good little French Canadians, right? And as it stands right now, if it turns out that, in fact, the notwithstanding clause can be used just because, you know, there happens to be a government that thinks it's a good idea to use it to take away our rights, then effectively, as minorities in this country, we don't have rights, but we have our permissions, right? Anything that seems to be popular with the majority of citizens, well, then we can do it. And if it's not popular, well, the government can take it away. And that's really, really dangerous. And I think it's important to point out that they did this to Muslim women, brown people who look different than us, right? And a large number of those people who are Muslim women are also Black people, right? Especially in Quebec, sub-Saharan Africans. But when they tried to use the notwithstanding clause to take away the rights of teachers, right, then the government wanted to do something before they even did it. So for us, this is really a question of, this is a structural question, right? Do we live in a country where provincial governments and the federal government can take away our rights just because the majority of people don't agree with how we live? It's exactly about the multicultural nature of our country and who we are growing into.
Okay. Now, this is that's a great segue into our next question, Eki. So this kind of relates to, Carl mentioned the getting into a taxi and the driver being Nigerian. Well, that could be an example of one of these many Nigerian doctors who can't get qualified and therefore driving a taxi, for example. And, you know, there are people calling for change, right? Different groups calling for equity. Well, there are strong forces pushing back against groups demanding equity, diversity, and inclusion that are fueling the popularity of people like Jordan Peterson. Okay, so this is a question again for everybody. What is the impact? What impact is this having on media, public discourse, and other areas like education? And how can we resist its spread? And this time we'll go Richard, Carl, Matthew, Stevens. We'll start with you, Richard.
Oh yeah. So I think we talked already about media being, you know, the media focuses on those loud dog whistles that get those clickbait and people watching commercials during the intermissions and that sort of thing. Like, media is not really the place that one finds, you know, sober stories about, you know, how to be thoughtful about what's happening. It's like they're going to amplify people who have views that are racist or anti-Semitic or anti-Black. So I don't have a lot of faith in media unless it's media that, you know, people produce. Like, I'm really a fan of the alternative media and the media that people produce on their own through YouTube or Facebook or other means where they can get messages out as long as they're not blocked by the service providers to engage populations. With respects to...
small segment from our most recent live panel, Off the Hill, Tackling Systemic Inequalities. We'd like to share a big thank you to our guests who appeared on this week's panel. To watch the full panel, please visit rabble.ca/rabbletv or visit our YouTube channel. If you missed this month's event and don't want to miss the next one, be sure to sign up for email reminders for events such as this at rabble.ca/alerts. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll hand it over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel shared findings from the Ottawa People's Commission report. The Ottawa People's Commission on the Convoy Occupation, or the OPC, held 14 hearings and 8 community meetings, received online and mailed submissions, and heard from more than 200 people about how last year's so-called Freedom Convoy impacted the lives of those living in Ottawa. The first part of their report, based on these findings, was released at the end of January. As Wenzel reports, the OPC is arguing people who lived and worked in Ottawa at the time of the occupation faced a barrage of widespread human rights abuses. Human rights lawyer and commissioner Lalani Farha explained how the police went out of their way to promote the right of freedom of expression for the occupiers, while ignoring the rights of residents to access to food, health care, and peaceful communities. Part 2 of the report is set to be released in March of 2023. The commission says it will provide further analysis as well as recommendations for action. Also in Canadian politics, parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg weighs in on the controversy surrounding the appointment of Amira Elawabe as Canada's first representative to combat Islamophobia. Nirenberg posits that a significant proportion of Francophone Quebecers see the appointment as an affront, and many of those who oppose Elawabe would probably object to anybody in the job, in part because they do not see Islamophobia as a serious problem. Those folks suspect the true purpose of this new position is to provide a platform from which to attack Quebec's Law 21, which prohibits public servants from wearing religious symbols at work. Nirenberg explains how supporters of Law 21 seem to focus less on those who wear Jewish kippahs or Christian crosses in public. He writes, quote, "They inevitably focus on the danger posed by Muslims, especially female Muslims. Further, Law 21 supporters often associate the mere wearing of hijab with the most extreme and violent expressions of Islam," end quote. This week in labor news, Rabble labor reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga covered the fight some Ontario librarians are facing for better wages and job security. Library workers who are members of QP Local 905 in Markham, Ontario, voted on a new deal with their employer on February 10th. The average pay for a librarian in the Markham Public Library system is about $30,000 a year. The new deal would increase librarian pay to be comparable to that of other regional library systems. Workers also secured a concession from their employer that workers cannot be transferred to another branch in the system without their consent. The results of the ratification vote have yet to be made public. Also this week on the Courage My Friends podcast series, host Resh Badu and special guests Madeline Ritz, Michelle Sraha Yeboa, and John Wire discuss the current mental health crisis as it relates to capitalism. They also break down some reinforced narratives about mental health for Black people and the impacts of racial inequality that continue to harm Black people's access to mental health services today. Catch up on this week's episode of the Courage My Friends podcast and previous episodes of this series on our sister podcast show, Needs No Introduction. Courage My Friends is a partnership between the Tommy Douglas Institute at George Brown College and with the support of the Douglas Caldwell Layton Foundation. Finally, columnist Natasha Darling examines the ways sex worker communities are coming together online to build new safe spaces for themselves after popular stripper and camp performer forum StripperWeb mysteriously shut down at the top of the month. As Darling writes, StripperWeb was a space where sex workers could find community with one another, provide tips and general advice, as well as list reviews about venues and commission peers to create outfits for them. Darling explains that the most of the forum's moderators were strippers or cam performers themselves, and so the forum was mostly free of voyeurs, a safe space before such wording even existed. Now that StripperWeb has closed its digital doors, where is a sex worker to go to find safe online community spaces? Read Darling's full breakdown on rabble.ca today. As always, you can find the full version of these stories and much, much more on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.